You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Hey, folks. Welcome. We're going to get started. Thanks for coming today. My name is Eric Hincus, and I'm a legal policy fellow with the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee. Today's event is hosted in conjunction with the Internet Caucus and its co-chairs, Senator Leahy, Senator Thune, Representative Goodlatte, and Representative Eshoo. Welcome to our panel discussion on mobile patents and innovation. The Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee is an NGO nonprofit. We don't take any positions on legislation or regulation, so we work with our numerous stakeholders to get our briefings on issues that are important for congressional members, staff, folks in the technology policy space, and the general public. Our educational programs provide a forum for collegial and balanced discussion, but I want to invite you to engage with each other and us through our social media channels and keep the conversation going on these important topics. So just as Congress was in the final days of passing the America Invents Act, the most sweeping change to the patent system in 60 years, mobile technology companies were in the midst of acquiring massive patent portfolios through mergers and acquisitions, and complex litigation between multiple parties and jurisdictions around the world was already underway. I previously convened and moderated a discussion on this important topic last January at our annual State of the Internet Conference. In the last 8 months, patent infringement litigation and the mobile space has continued to increase at a frenetic pace in multiple countries and jurisdictions around the globe. And as we enter a new Congress early next year, this is an important issue to talk about. So here's the numbers to keep in mind. Of more than 8.3 million U.S. patents since 1792, more than a quarter have been issued after the year 2000. One recent study indicates that the number of U.S. patent lawsuits has increased at an average of 4.9% per year since 1991, while patents issued has grown an average of 4.5%. Most importantly today, we want to talk about what these disputes mean for each of you, your constituents, stakeholders, and for marketplace innovation. Will a competitor force your favorite mobile device off the market, or will a native feature on your device be disabled as a result of a patent dispute? Our panel of experts will share their unique perspectives on mobile patents and innovation, as well as their thoughts on what patent issues lie on the horizon and the evolving mobile device space yet to be addressed. So we're pleased to have an exceptional group of panelists today. I want to thank them for participating. I'll briefly introduce them, and then we'll get right into it. You can tweet about today's event using the hashtag mobile patents. So I'd like to first introduce Professor Contreras. I'll introduce Marvin Amore. Thank you. Marvin Amore is a principal of the Amore Group and steering committee for engine advocacy. He is internationally recognized as a leader in internet law and public policy. He has worked on a range of public policy issues, including patents, copyright, telecommunications, competition, privacy, free speech, and international issues. He has briefed cases in the Supreme Court, argued before multiple circuits, and practiced before the FCC, FTC, and Congress. Professor Contreras is an associate professor of law at Washington College of Law at American University. He currently teaches in the areas of IP transactions, law and science, and property law. His research focuses primarily on the effects of IP structures on the dissemination and production of scientific and technological innovation. Prior to joining the faculty at Washington College of Law, he was a senior lecturer and acting director of the IP program at WashU and St. Louis School of Law and an IP partner at WilmerHale. We also have Professor Massoff today. Professor Massoff is professor of law at George Mason University School of Law. He teaches and writes in the areas of property and IP law. His research focuses on the intersection between IP law and property theory, with a special emphasis on natural rights philosophy and its role in the intellectual history of patent law. He has published a number of articles in topics in patent law, property law, legal history, and legal philosophy in several leading law journals. He teaches a range of courses, including patent law, property, jurisprudence, and property theory. And finally, today we're joined by Rob Pergoraro. He's a technology writer and columnist for multiple outlets, including USA Today and Discovery News. He's been trying to make sense of computers, consumer electronics, telecom services, the internet, software, and other things that link, beat, or break through reporting and analysis from 1991 to 2011 as the Washington Post tech columnist and now for a variety of online and print outlets. His work has put him behind podiums, on panels, as well as on radio and TV. So I'd like to first open the floor to each of our panelists today to share some brief thoughts on this topic as we get started. If I may ask, please use as few acronyms as possible. Marvin, welcome.
Thanks. All right, it's good to see everyone here. I just have a few thoughts initially. One is that there's sort of two different patent problems that people talk about. One, people talk about patent trolls, which are companies that don't make anything. They simply stockpile thousands of patents or hundreds of patents and then license them or to companies that don't license their patents. And so the patent troll problem is talked about fairly often. The second issue people talk about has to do with the big companies you've heard of, Apple, Samsung, Google, in patent litigation over smartphone technologies. And both of them are sort of related, but they might have different solutions. And one of the, sort of my background, where I come to how I view this issue is that we have a major problem when it comes to software and hardware technology patents. That's the area I know best. He mentioned that I'm on the steering committee of a group called Engine Advocacy. It's a coalition that represents startups in D.C. It's 300 startups based in San Francisco. And so I've talked to a lot of startups, small companies, about the problem of, you know, patent trolls suing them, of having the issue of having to take time away from building a product, focusing on building a company, and have to instead go to depositions, hire a lawyer, try to work through, you know, the real fear of being sued by some company with, you know, a bottomless bank account and an endless army of lawyers and 100 shell companies. My sort of take, which will come out in the discussion, is that the patent system at the moment is fairly broken when it comes to technology patents, far more than, say, in some other areas.
Thank you. Professor Contreras.
Great. Thanks very much. So I fully sympathize with Marvin Hughes. I mean, in my view, patent trolled, and there is a lot of troll litigation, and a large amount of money is being spent on that litigation that probably could be better used elsewhere. But I see patent trolls and troll litigation not as an underlying problem, but as a symptom of a problem that exists in the patent system. Patent trolls, by and large, I mean, there are obviously exceptions, but by and large, they are simply doing what the law allows them to do. They're collecting patents that were issued by the patent office. You can buy and sell these patents, and you can sue on them. So they're not breaking any laws. They're not doing anything wrong per se, as detrimental as their activity might be overall to the economy. The real problem, I think, is in the patent system itself and the number of patents that we issue and the breadth of those patents. And it really boils down to the claims of patents that are allowed by the Patent and Trademark Office in technology industries like software, but also consumer electronics and more, even in the biomedical sciences. And what we allow in this country is for people to claim property rights over not just over their invention, but over any idea that they can come up with that might relate to an invention. And it sounds like kind of an academic difference, but it actually is a big difference because with many patents, it's really patent lawyers who are creating the inventions. You may invent a nifty feature of something and you can claim it in your patent. Your patent will also have 50 or 100 other claims that claim sort of related things that are reasonable extrapolations that are very broadly worded. And then you have a property right over all of that as well. And that creates a lot of confusion in the marketplace. It creates uncertainty. And when the patents get sold to non-practicing entities, trolls, patent assertion entities, whatever you want to call them, there's a lot of trouble in the marketplace. So we can talk about this in more detail as we move on.
Thank you, Professor Massa.
Thank you. I appreciate, Eric, that you read my official, very hoity-toity sounding description on from my bio, my webpage. I actually also teach internet law because I am a self-professed geek, and I think in some respects that is a much more important accolade to have here than all the other stuff that you read. I bring somewhat of a historical perspective to these issues. I've been researching the history of the American patent system for most of my academic career, and one thing that I've been startled at is that everything that is claimed to be new today about the alleged broken patent system, about so-called patent trolls, about so-called patent thickets, there is absolutely nothing new about this. In fact, the very first patent thicket in the American patent system was in the 1850s, and it was called at that time by the newspapers the sewing machine war because it involved all of these patentees on the sewing machine suing each other in court and had all of the issues you have today, massive litigation, multiple parties, multiple venues, complex technology, judges complaining about the ability to figure out what the particular inventive contribution was, satellite litigation, in the patent office about whether the inventions were novel or not. And even better, you had a non-practicing entity, Elias Howe, who patented the lock stitch, was going around suing manufacturers. He was a non-practicing entity. He made all of his money from licensing. In fact, he was recognized at the time as by newspapers as having, quote, sued his way to fame and fortune, unquote. And as a general matter, the sewing machine war is not the first or the last time that we've witnessed patent wars. Patent wars have occurred with every single major technological leap forward. The telephone, the electric light, the radio, airplanes, computer technology, and even surprisingly, disposable diapers and medical stents in the 1980s. If you talk to patent lawyers today, they will tell you all about the diaper wars of the 1980s. For those of you who are parents, you can appreciate disposable diapers and the technology that that involves. And these were hundreds of million dollar judgments. This is a multi-billion dollar industry. And yet innovation continued apace because the courts enforced the patents, they recognized the property rights, they issued injunctions, they leveled damage awards. Parties knew exactly where they stood with respect to each other, and then after the lawsuits, they, where necessary, they entered into licensing agreements, and the technology continued. And we have diapers today, we have medical stents today, we have sewing machines today, we have radios today, we have computers today. It was a result of what economists call private ordering mechanisms, the reliance upon property and contract to resolve these disputes. And so my perspective on these is a historical perspective is essentially kind of, I constantly feel like Douglas Adams telling people, don't panic from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. There's nothing new here. And I really, I really call upon people to question the rhetoric, such labels like patent trolls and patent thickets, and to recognize that, despite this rhetoric and the claims of a so-called broken patent system, innovation has continued in our patent system with all of these same alleged problems before, and innovation will continue to this day. In fact, we all have our smartphones. We all have our tablets. Here I am with my infringing Samsung device. I have it. It's not shut down, and it will continue. It will, you know, I predict a license will eventually be entered into between Samsung and Apple once the litigation is finally resolved. So thank you.
As the one token non-academic with no actual credentials to be in here, I'll forge it anyways. I'll start with the phrase we all sort of forgot to mention, promote the progress of science and useful arts. The patent system is supposed to do that. If it results in more creative, better functioning products over time, then great. The legal costs are acceptable. I don't think we can make that case in the smartphone environment where, on the one hand, you have this vast increase of patents. Software was traditionally not patentable. That's run away. I don't think anyone will say the Patent and Trademark Office did a terrific job in the 1990s evaluating the sudden flood of patents, but they're still around. They're presumed valid. It's a slow and expensive process to get them overturned. The phrase I use is the half-life of all these stupid software patents we are stuck with. Many are now the property of non-practicing entities that don't have a motivation to do a cross-licensing deal. They don't have any product that they can make better with someone else's patent. I think this is something new. I think this is a problem for customers who don't actually know if the phone they're looking to buy is not going to get yanked off the market. It's a problem in the U.S., especially in a problem, and it's a particular problem in Germany, where I guess the courts will hand out an injunction if you ask nicely enough. And the other thing is, if you talk to people who are actually working on this in Silicon Valley, by and large, they hate the patent system. A lot of people at startups, you talk to the people pitching their ideas at conferences like Demo or TechCrunch Disrupt or Distilled Intelligence just down the street last week, they didn't have time for this. They're trying to ship a product. They don't have $10,000 to send a lawyer off to the Patent and Trademark Office to get the ball rolling on that. They're going to invent first, and I think a lot of them are just hoping that they're not going to run aground of something. Even the ones who try, I think they're going to be surprised in an unpleasant way. So it's broken.
Okay. So the first question I'd like to throw out to each of you is, can mobile device companies simply innovate around these intellectual property disputes? I mean, is there a market-based solution for this, or does a solution lie somewhere else, perhaps in Congress or in the courts? Arvind, if you'd like to take a first stab at that.
Sure. I'm not, at the moment, they're sort of plodding along. I mean, the large companies are suing each other and entering into deals, trying to work it out. But the system we've set up isn't really conducive to innovating around all these patents. And so just for a moment, contrast the tech industry with, say, the pharmaceutical industry. Now, patents, most people seem to think it works well there. In the pharmaceutical industry, you have a product that will often have one or two patents for a specific molecule. You have very high costs to bring it to market. And then the value of that molecule or that patent actually lasts the full 20 years. Viagra will be valuable as a patent for 20 years. But when you go to the tech side, you don't have a specific molecule that has just two patents on it or one or two patents. You have a device with thousands of patents on it. I think you have to sort of clear and figure out the patents aren't for specific things. They're for general ideas often. And the value of a 20-year patent isn't all that large for a product that might be obsolete within a year or two. And when the value of bringing out a product early is being the first out there. So if you're in a world where you have devices with thousands of patents on lots of different devices, you have a sort of more complicated world to patent around. And it's almost as though, the analogy law professors sometimes use is imagine you took a field and you gave everyone, every farmer, a very small slice of the field, and nobody really had enough property rights not to be infringing on other people and to actually use the whole field productively. And so we essentially set up the property system where it's not efficient, I think, in that market.
Thank you. Professor Ferris.
Great. So, designing around a smartphone. So, like law professors do, I have three ways to address that. Three things. There are three types of patents. And it's important because this litigation has a lot of issues floating around, and often they're not separated, and so it gets confusing. Especially with the Apple-Samsung case, a lot of the dispute was around design patents, right? What the thing, what the phone actually looked like, the curves, the colors, the bevels, those sorts of things. Design patents are pretty narrow. We're going to learn more, as this case gets appealed as to how narrow they really are. But those are also easy to design around. Samsung undoubtedly already has people working at its factories and design shops to come up with new designs that do not infringe those design patents, changing the shape of the icons, the layout on the screen. That's easy. A software designer can do that in a day. So the design patent piece is very easy to design around. And frankly, I think Samsung, HTC, others will come up with more innovation, more innovative designs, shapes, figures, and so forth, as a result of not being able to use the designs that Apple used. That's the design patents. Again, but I think that's really a red herring in this overall discussion because design patent litigation is not very common in electronics, and it's not really that prevalent among the other companies. There are two other types of patents to talk about. The other extreme from design patents are standards essential patents, right? These are the patents that cover the telecommunications, the interconnect standards that make things like phones work, USB plugs, the Wi-Fi connectivity, Bluetooth connectivity. All of those protocols that have names are generally industry standards, and by and large, the patents that cover those are called standards essential patents, and the people who own the patents have usually committed to license those to anybody who wants a license on fair, reasonable, non-discriminatory terms, which itself is a very complicated issue. And there's litigation going on right now between Motorola, Google, and Microsoft, and Apple, and lots of other companies around whether those commitments were honored to license on fair terms. Those patents really can't be designed around. If you want your phone to connect, to use a 4G LTE network, you have to infringe an essential patent. So that's the other end of the spectrum. But the thing that's really complicated and the thing that I think is the most problematic is in the middle with these what are called utility patents, these broad patents that aren't essential to standards but that cover other features of products. So in the Apple-Samsung case, these are the patents around tap to zoom and pinch to zoom, right? The things that you do, physical actions you take with your phone, they're not really technological patents. They have nothing to do with the really complicated and very cool glass or sensor technology that make all of those things happen. They are just about the idea of pulling your fingers apart on a screen, using two gestures to cause an image to get larger or to resize. Right? That's what they cover. And those, I think, are problematic and too broad and will get difficult to design around. We can talk about how they those types of claims could get narrowed. But I think that's where we'll run into the real difficulty.
Professor Massa.
Thank you. It's great that Jorge mentioned the designer on, because in fact, I have my infringing device, and I got a system update about 2 weeks ago where they removed the slide to unlock as a button, and it's just you just swipe the screen and it unlocks. That's a design around. Now they're no longer infringing the button slide to unlock. In the context of the nature of the law and the tech crisis today, I'd like to read to you a quote from a very important judge. Quote, patents and copyrights approach nearer than any other class of cases to what may be called the metaphysics of the law, where the distinctions are at the very least subtle and refined and sometimes almost evanescent. End quote. Now, you might be thinking maybe that was Judge Posner in one of his recent rants about software patents, but that was actually stated by Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story in 1841 in deciding a patent case. And so I think it's very, and in fact, it's great that pharma patents were mentioned, because I just did a blog posting this morning on Truth on the Market blog where I quote from early pharmaceutical patent cases from about 100 years ago, in which very important judges like Judge Learned Hand are saying the exact same things about pharmaceutical patents 100 years ago that we're now saying today about software patents. We don't lack the technical expertise. It's difficult to figure these things out. We need specialists maybe to, you know, we need to hire tons of specialist judges and examiners at the patent office to figure these things out. Again, historical perspective and actual empirical data, as opposed to impressionistic intuitions and emotionally compelling anecdotes, I think are really the solution to the sense that there's a legal crisis here, because we are not experiencing anything new today that has not occurred repeatedly in the patent system, and yet we have amazing innovation that has been brought about by our patent system. Sewing machines, airplanes, radios, your computer technology, automobiles, everything that you are using today has been patented at one time or other over the past 200 years.
And the web was not.
some aspects of the web, the computer technology on which it runs was the hardware. So what can we do today? I think the most important thing we can do is recognize and enforce the property rights as provided in the law, because the worst thing you can do when parties are engaged in lawsuits over new radical leap forwards in technology is signal to them, either from Congress or the courts or regulatory agencies, that the rules are going to change 6 months from now, or the rules are going to change a year from now as to who has what rights. Because then what you do create is the incentive for people to hold out longer, whether they're infringers or plaintiffs, and not settle because they're unclear about who might actually be, what their property rights might be down the road. And you cannot have licensing or contracts until you first have the definite, secure property rights. As I teach my students, property is the subject matter of contracts. And in fact, the very first solution to the very first patent crisis, the sewing machine war of the 1850s, was the creation of a private solution to that patent thicket. And it was the very first patent pool in U.S. history. It was called the Sewing Machine Combination of 1856, where all of these different patentees got together and they said, you know, it's not in our interest to be suing each other. We really should cross-license with each other so we can all get down to the business of making money by manufacturing sewing machines. They didn't need, and that wasn't brought about by Congress. That wasn't brought about by judges or the patent office. That was brought about by the patent owners themselves recognizing that this was in their interest. And patent pools historically have been the solution to overlapping multiple patents. MPEG technology is the product of a patent pool. DVDs is a product of a patent pool. This is not a new phenomenon of having hundreds of overlapping patents on a single technological product. So I think the best thing we can do is let the lawsuits continue and stop signaling to the various patent owners and potential infringers and potential more plaintiffs that the legal ground will change and be uncertain. I think the most important thing we can do is let them know that your property rights today will be the same property rights tomorrow. Now, pursue your lawsuits, get your judgments, and then pursue your licensing, which is the historical pattern we've had.
I don't think we can make that promise anyways. There are a lot of court cases coming up in the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, possibly at the Supreme Court, that could knock out a whole lot of software patents. So, and there's also the background that, like it or not, intellectual property is not real property. It expires at a set date. The government can take it away under certain circumstances. It is not like the house that, once you pay off the bank, you own, period. It's a right we made up for the sake of making society as a whole, the whole science and useful arts thing, better. So that should be the priority, not the property rights of individual companies. As for whether you can innovate around it, in a way you could say you could. I was looking at the timetable of Samsung Apple. They filed, it was April 2011, right? And this thing has gotten to the court verdict in a year and change, which is really fast. Of course, it's still got to go through appeals. This is a long way from anybody writing a check to anybody else. Well, think about what your iPhone was like in April of 2011. There was no Siri. There was no Apple Maps, so I might regard that as an upgrade. There was no LTE, no 8 megapixel camera. If you have an Android phone then, there was no NFC chip that may at some point do something useful. A lot of the capabilities we take for granted did not exist. So in that time, things have advanced so fast. If you just look at the phones that Apple went after, most of them are off the market. The ones that are not are in the cutout bin. So if anything, I almost wonder what Apple is trying to do. As a denial of service weapon, a patent lawsuit is kind of crude and definitely not quick.
The next issue I want to raise with our panelists is the recently passed American Invents Act, and that represents a collective multi-year effort by many folks. I worked on the Hill back when it was called Patent Reform Act of 2005. So, I wonder if this is going to have a significant impact or any impact on litigation or on continued innovation in the mobile space. If so, what's the impact? And if not, why not? Marvin, take first stab at that.
Sure. So when the act passed, Ars Technica had an article that was called "Mostly Pointless Patent Reform Goes to Obama." And in the summer, with Engine Advocacy at a sort of venture firm, we had two congressmen come visit, and a whole bunch of startups were talking to the congressmen about some of their issues, and they mentioned patents, and the congressman looked at them and said, "Didn't we just reform the Patent Act? Didn't we just take care of this all?" And they said, "No, there's still a lot more work to be done." And so I can let others discuss some of the reasons why. I mean, I think the solution, you've seen lots of proposed solutions to some of the different problems. Some of the problems have to do with design patents. Some argue that they're too obvious, that we should, think that we should only get patents to are less obvious. Some argue that we're now getting patents to ideas, so we're doing what people call functional claiming, and we should instead give patents to the actual technology. Others argue that there's a problem with standard essential patents. There are arguments on both sides of all of these. I come down more and more on where Richard Posner, the judge who rants it, apparently. Richard Posner is, I think, the most celebrated judge alive, sort of the best-known law and economics scholar, a conservative appointed by Reagan. And he has been recently arguing that software patents, essentially he's been arguing for different reforms, but he's questioned the whole idea of having software patents, period. They don't promote innovation at all. Recently, the Nobel Prize winner from 2007 in economics wrote a letter to the New York Times saying, "You had an anti-patent article recently, but you didn't go far enough. There was no justification for software patents." Anyone who's heard the This American Life about patent trolls, if you haven't, you should listen to it. It's all about how patent trolls set up office in the Eastern District of Texas and file litigation that's very favorable in this one district. And so to the extent that there are fixes that you can make, I tend to think that really the core solution would be eliminating the property right in general. And so I'll just give, since we've had a strong defense of patent rights, there's a sort of argument in the patent law literature that you would teach to any law school class that all you need to do is give strong, broad patent rights, and then the market will figure it out. People will just license and cross-license. No worries, we can sit back, and the market will solve it. I mean, to the extent that the government's out there conferring broad grants of property, it's already involved to some extent in making a substantive decision. But what we've seen just sort of in the market itself is that it doesn't work so well. It's almost as though we have, we all have property rights in our houses that go straight up, essentially to infinity. And so somebody can't, throw a ball at you in the air without trespassing. But at a certain point, those property rights go away so that planes can fly overhead without having to cut a deal with every single home they fly over for the property right to fly overhead. What we have in the patent world, in the software and smartphone world, is essentially the requirement to have to get thousands of different licenses. You have to think through all these different patents. And that's not a sound property system. Right? And to the extent that there might be historical examples, I mean, I talk to startups all the time. You know, I go to a party in San Francisco, and friends of mine, I remember running into the general counsel of Dropbox, and he said, oh, yeah, all of us got sued today by Patent Trolls, so all the top companies. Yes, a friend of mine who has a startup, a serial entrepreneur, an early PayPal guy. And I said, oh, you know, is it common to be sued by a troll or by another company and have to deal with these issues? And he said, you're not doing anything right if you're not getting sued by a troll. And so we've essentially set up a system that according to Dick Posner and other economists, harms innovation rather than promotes it. And I think simply saying that we've had this problem before is like saying, oh, we've had real, you know, land wars and bombings throughout history. It's okay. Like, we can actually make a difference and improve the world by changing the laws. And we can do that through Congress or through other mechanisms.
What additional legislation?
There's no legislation?
No, I think you said what additional legislation?
Oh, what additional legislation? I think something as simple as eliminating business type of patents, software patents, and sort of defining it fairly as well as we can and then letting it sort out would be the best way to go. Other things to do would be to raise the obviousness standard on some of these patents. I think that there's an institutional problem. Right? There are lots of arguments about, there are economic arguments, but also institutional arguments. So there's a really great young scholar, he's at Illinois, who's done a lot of institutional analysis of how much money the patent office makes for each patent they grant in each different industry, and how it turns out that, magically, they grant more patents in certain industries based on their fees and the recurring fees that they get. And so some of the incentives under the patent office and the way that their money is tied to patent fees. Some things having to do with the Federal Circuit. There's been a lot of criticism of the fact that 20 years ago, the U.S. government stood up a separate appellate court for patents. It's been aggressively pro-patent, according to most critics. And there are also these other institutional considerations. Now that patents are litigated and talked about, we patent lawyers have more prestige, et cetera, so it's beneficial to us. There are lots of things that, the Eastern District of Texas does to encourage patent litigation. So if you can get at some of these institutional issues, make it hard for the Eastern District of Texas to attract litigation so that people don't go and sue in this one district that's favorable to trolls, do other things. I don't know what you do about the Federal Circuit. One of the institutional proposals by Dick Posner, that judge again, is to sort of provide more education to trial judges and district judges handling these cases. And maybe just I'm not sure as an institutional matter what the different solutions could be in addition to the substantive point of increasing the bar on obviousness and sort of figuring out the standard essential issue.
Professor Contreras, also I'd like your view on that with respect to the American Invents Act and additional legislation, if any, that you would think might be useful.
I tend to agree that after 8 years and a lot of back and forth, the American Invents Act turned out to be pretty uninspiring. And there are 18 different provisions, 18 different procedural changes. And some of them, may have some effect. Some were intended to deal with patent troll litigation or a joinder of multiple defendants in suits. Nobody knows if that's going to help or hurt the system. You can now challenge patents after they're issued, but really it's only for 9 months after the patents are issued. After 9 months, you can only bring very limited challenges. So, and you can see the amount of compromise that went into a lot of these provisions, and a lot of other provisions just got knocked out, very close to the end. So I the AIA, I think, is a small baby step forward. I don't think it really does a heck of a lot. That being said, there are plenty of things. Talk to any, patent lawyer, law professor. They'll have a whole list for you of different legal changes that could be made to help the system. And I think they fall into two categories, right? There are changes and reforms to the Patent Act itself, and then changes relating to litigation and procedure. A lot of the waste and a lot of the cost that we're seeing comes from some of the litigation practices that are permitted in this country. So, on the patent system reforms, and I think it's probably obvious from my earlier comments, I think that tightening up the rules around patent claiming is important. I think just as just, as Marvin alluded to, the business method patents, which, you know, are limited a tiny bit under the AIA, could be limited a lot more and or eliminated entirely. And business method patents are not technological inventions. They are just ways of doing something, of a method of hedging investment risk, right? This is a famous one, the Bilski case you may have heard of, a method of organizing mutual funds in a hub and spoke structure, right? That's not the real hub and it's not a real spoke. It's just a business concept that got patented in the famous Federal Circuit case, State Street Bank, and really ushered in this world of business method patents. And I would, you know, counter to Professor Mossoff that this is the difference between today and the older cases, the 19th century, the sewing machine cases, even the stent and the diaper cases. Those weren't cases about a method of putting on a diaper onto a baby. I mean, those were cases about, I don't know, the plastic, the cloth, the chemicals, you know, the structure of the diapers, things, physical things that you could consider an invention. And yes, maybe a sewing machine is complicated, an airplane, a computer, they're complicated, a diaper is less complicated, but even an uncomplicated but physical invention strikes me as worthy of a patent. But a way of doing business seems to go over the line, because I honestly don't think that you incentivize innovation in business methods by issuing patents. Sewing machines, yes. Airplanes, stents, yes. I think it's a good idea to give people patents when they improve and invent new incarnations of these things. But I think that there's plenty of incentive in the business world to develop new business methods simply because they give you an advantage in the business world. And a patent is just gravy that ultimately the banks and investment companies don't even use themselves. They sell them off to patent enforcement companies because they can make a few extra bucks doing that. So why not? The system allows it, but it does allow for a lot of unnecessary litigation. Now, as far as software, I wouldn't necessarily go as far as Marvin and, you know, say we shouldn't have software patents because some software is very complicated to write. It's inventive, has never been done before, and the software we have today is a lot more complicated than what we had, you know, 20, 30 years ago for very good reasons. And I suspect that some of that is worth protecting. But software patents covers a really broad swath of territory these days. It's not just a complicated computer algorithm for measuring, you know, temperature on the surface of the sun, right? Something like that. Complicated software probably required some physicists to get together and write it. No, people refer to software patents by, Tap to Zoom is a so-called software patent. It really doesn't have much to do with the software itself, which is probably quite complicated. It doesn't have to do with the sensors, with the fancy glass, anything like that. It's just an idea that a patent lawyer came up with in a design session with the engineers who were actually creating it. And why not patent the idea of spreading your fingers apart with a gesture to change the size of the image? If you can patent that, you should, because that will cover a lot more than the actual technology you invented to do it. So I think that if we're going to institute changes to the patent law, we should narrow down the scope of what you can patent. And on the litigation procedure side, there are so many things, and I don't want to bore you with them. One thing that we haven't mentioned yet, but that is a hot topic in a lot of legal circles, is the International Trade Commission, the ITC, which now people use as sort of a parallel litigation system with the federal courts in the United States. So if you're sued for patent infringement, you're not just sued in federal court in Texas, you're also sued in Washington here at the ITC at the same time for the same patents, for the exact same product. And the ITC was set up to be a tribunal to, you know, help American companies be protected from imports by foreign companies that you couldn't reach jurisdictionally. They're abroad. You know, how can you sue a company, making counterfeit products in Hong Kong? You can't even find where their factory is. The only thing you can do is stop the goods at the border. So, you know, hence the ITC was born. Today, it's used by U.S. companies fighting each other. you know, Apple, Motorola, Microsoft, these are U.S. companies. What in the world are they doing at the International Trade Commission? Yet it is absolutely standard practice in litigation these days to go to the ITC. You know, I was at a big law firm. You'd be sued for malpractice if you didn't advise your client to go to the ITC at the same time that you were going to federal court. So some limitation on ITC jurisdiction in the case of domestic disputes. Even though, yes, the phones are coming in from China, they're coming in from abroad, it's a U.S. company that's manufacturing them. So, again, that's a little pet peeve of mine that I wanted to get off my chest. There are many more procedural things I'm sure that could be improved, but I will cede to Professor Massa.
Professor Massa.
Hi.
Your view as well.
Oh, I wish that the dominant perspective in law, in the academy and in law school classes was enforce strong property rights and patents and the market will resolve itself. Mark, I highly recommend you come with me to a the next patent law conference and you will hear the exact opposite from the majority of my colleagues.
I didn't say it was dominant. I was in every
law school class. But
and this is the podcast.
I think what's surprising is that what's not been mentioned yet, which is that the AIA hasn't even been fully implemented yet, and the proponents of the AIA, I think rightly characterized it as the greatest change to the U.S. patent system since 1836, because that was with the Patent Act of 1836, which erected the framework of our modern patent system that we have in the United States. And they said this is the most massive change to the U.S. patent system since that time, and it truly is. I mean, it adopted a much more muscular post-grant review procedure, adopted several other post-issuance review procedures. It established prior user defenses. It shifts us to a first-to-file defense. Many of these things haven't even been implemented yet. We don't even know the impact that this is going to have on patenting yet. We have no data yet, and we're already talking about changing the patent system some more and signaling to the firms that are trying to decide whether to invest $500 billion in a new patent. Well, you know, is that going to be an enforceable patent 10 years from now? You know, the Federal Circuit is now reviewing whether they should whether software patents should be patented or not. We don't know if we're going to invest in that. And in fact, I was on the Hill last year speaking on behalf of the U.S. Business and Industry Council, which represents small firms and small businesses and individual investors and individual inventors who were largely arguing against the AIA because they saw that it imposed substantial more costs on their ability vis-a-vis large firms with massive R&D departments who can hire massive numbers of lawyers who can defend their interests in bringing quickly inventions to the patent office. So, and in fact, the reference to the 1836 Patent Act is also significant because you often hear on this panel and from many people today that we're in the midst of a patent litigation explosion and that patent litigation is out of control. And yet you don't often hear what the exact numbers are. Well, let me give you some of the numbers because numbers are always good, right? or at least maybe for a geek, numbers are good. The patent litigation rate today, which is the total number of patents being litigated versus the total number of patents being issued, is 1.5%. The average patent litigation rate in the year 1790 to 1860 was 1.65%. Pretty impressive, right? So this time when they were just patenting machines and everything was easy and good, it's the average rate, the average litigation rate. You don't just look at the absolute numbers without context. You need context. It's how many patents are being litigated versus how many patents are being issued. Because if that's the case, if you don't contextualize and normalize the statistics, then you end up with, oh my God, we're in the midst of a crisis because so many people go to the hospital now that they didn't before, and so many people injure themselves now because there's a larger population. You have to normalize, so the normal is how many patents are issuing versus how many patents are being litigated, and that rate has remained roughly steady. And in fact, it's great to note that the complaints about the ITC. People love to cite statistics on the ITC. The ITC has seen like an explosive percentage growth in its patent filings. Well, the total number of patent filings in the ITC, cases brought by IP owners was in fiscal year 2011 was 70. The total number of patent infringement lawsuits brought in district courts in this country, so in standard trial courts, 3,000. And in fact, the ITC numbers just came out for their fiscal year a week ago, and they showed that the total number of cases instituted by patent owners has dropped from 70 to 48, from fiscal year 2011 to fiscal year 2012. So even on even not normalizing, just looking at the straight numbers, you have almost a half drop in the number of total patents being patent cases being filed at the ITC. To me, that's not a patent crisis. That's everything exact opposite. You have actually reduction in the number of cases being filed. And then lastly, the claims about that, you know, oh, well, you know, patents are on software today or business methods and not on machines the way they used to be. There's been a great article that was just recently published by Michael Risch called America's First Patents, where he had been hearing these claims and he said, well, let's go and look at, and he actually read the 3,700 patents that issued between 1790 and 1839. And he found a lot of really surprising, interesting things. For instance, that these patents were very vague. Some of them were incoherent. Some were unintelligible because they were handwritten. This is before typewriters. But even more impressively, he found a substantial number of business method patents. I mean, not an insignificant percentage of patents that issued in that period were actually patents on methods of doing business. In fact, the United States was broke with England when we erected our patent system in 1790 because England in the 18th century did not permit patenting of processes at all. They considered methods to be abstract ideas and unpatentable. And one of the very first things we instituted in our very first Patent Act of 1790 was you could patent a machine, but you could also patent a process. And that's, in fact, why, for instance, people were getting patents on business methods, because business methods are a type of process. And so, again, I think that it's significant that the AIA, which has radically restructured our patent system, one of the most radical restructurings in 150 years, let's give that some time to work out. I think, you know, the best thing that Congress can do right now is to say, okay, we passed a radical reform. It has staggered implementation. The first to file doesn't get implemented until this coming March. The post-grant review and other new review procedures for post-issuance at the Patent Office just went into effect last month in mid-September. Let's get some data on that. Let's see how that works out. Let's find out what the impact is on patenting, what the impact is on patent litigation rates, before we start jumping up and down and saying we need to continue to fix the system. Because a legal system in flux is not a legal system that provides security to people and the use of the entitlements that they're obtaining from the government. In fact, we just experienced massively in this economy the past 4 years, what happens when there's massive uncertainty about property rights? It was called the housing market crisis of 2008 to 2012. Right? When people didn't, and what happened there? People didn't, were uncertain about who owned what mortgages and what property rights existed because these mortgages had been sliced and diced so much that there was uncertainty about what those property rights were. And the housing market came to a crash and brought our entire economy down. And so we don't want to repeat that same level of uncertainty in the patent system. We certainly don't. We're a patent system that has brought amazing innovation in this country, from computers to smartphones to laser technology, to radio, to automobiles, to even weapons of sorts, Colt, you know, and farming implements, going all the way back to the 19th century and the telegraph and whatnot. So I think our system is doing a fairly good job, has done a fairly good job, and I think we should now take a breather and let the reforms be implemented and let the courts resolve the cases as they are.
Three points. One, I would certainly agree that if you ask Congress to do nothing on an issue, you will probably have your wish granted. Two,
yes.
I do want to take a look at the number of patents, because if you look at the stats on the PTO's site, it's interesting. 1963, it's a total number of 85,000. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I have to pinch to zoom. 1,869. You go back to zoom out. 75, 101,000 change. 83, 103,000 and change. In this time, we're inventing the integrated circuit, the computer, the touchscreen, a lot of the technology we use all the time. 87, 127, almost 128,000. And then we have this bit of a hockey stick point in the graph where in 97, we topped 215,000 for the first time. We hit 300,000 in 2001. We broke the half million barrier for utility patent applications in 2011. I think we're a pretty smart, nation. Well, I guess there's international applicants as well. I don't know that we've gotten five times smarter than we were in the 1960s. I think that there may be some more to the stats than we see, more to patents than the patent market than the numbers alone show. Now, as for American Invents Act, I do want to sort of compliment the PTO for one thing it's done. a lot of people who really don't like the patent system do appreciate how AIA seems to make it easier to surface prior art. And the PTO seems to be doing a good job. They've set up a site called Ask Patents. They went to a site called Stack Exchange, where a lot of programmers collaborate to try to solve problems, saying, help us build a site. They got on Google as well, so we can sort of crowdsource prior art so that we don't get fooled by somebody who writes a set of claims very cleverly, and we miss the fact that, you know, actually there's this open source library that does this, or somebody invented this already. That's a good step, and I think the fact that they went out of their way, they could have just, you know, hired the usual government contractor to set up some crowdsourced prior art site. They actually went to people who are good at getting programmers to share their knowledge. That's a good sign.
Okay. I want to ensure we have enough time for questions, so I just have one more question for our panelists as we go down. For these lawsuits, just the natural byproduct of innovation in this rapidly evolving space, how does this end, or will it, and what does it mean for innovation and for consumers until then? Marvin, take first stab at that.
Okay, so I just want to begin with the 1% mathematics that was going on.
100%.
Whatever the numbers were. I mean, essentially, one of the accusations now is that we have far too many patents that aren't very good. And so that if there's a smaller percentage of people suing based on far more patents that are of lower quality, then that doesn't actually rebut our point, it more defends the point. So that's one thought. So in terms of how this will end, I mean, when you talk about we should have security for patent holders and property owners and people who have invested billions of dollars in buying up patents, putting them into shell companies, and then suing companies that actually make products, we also need security for people who are innovating and making stuff. And when you look at where job growth comes from in this country, for the last 30 years, it's come from startups, come from high-growth startups. When you look at where innovation comes from, it often comes from startups. It was one of the reasons why companies like Apple, acquire companies that makes Siri. You get innovations from small companies. Often those are acquired. I mean, Google acquired Android, right? A lot of our best innovations come from startups. To the extent that we're not providing security for startups to innovate without the threat of litigation and being shaken down, we're not providing security for innovation. Right? The point of our patent system is to promote innovation, not to promote property rights. Right? Property rights are a means to an end, and a means that are effective in pharma, not in tech as much. One of the things that will happen if this litigation continues is we'll see a lot more defensive patenting. Everyone sort of becomes part of the problem, right? Because other people are out there patenting a lot, then you have to patent as well. And so one example is, Apple apparently became litigious and Steve Jobs decided to patent everything in the iPhone after he lost a $100 million patent case with Creative Technologies over the iPod, right? And so seeing that issue, he sort of went to the other extreme of patenting everything and becoming litigious. Twitter, right, has to patent everything. And because engineers are so opposed to the idea of patenting these, silly basic things that they do, right, Twitter actually has a license with their engineers promising that they'll only use the patents defensively. Right? I mean, when Yahoo tried to sue Facebook and became a troll and stuff like that, got attacked. But the culture around these technology companies is not in favor of patents, it's in favor of innovating. But they're pushed to have defensive patenting. So I think what we'll see is a lot more defensive patenting, a lot more litigation. We might see a patent pool, right, where all the companies who are fighting each other come together and pool things together. We've heard some great praise for patent pools. Some of the patent pools, I'm near the historian, but from what I understand, some of those were encouraged by the government. Like the airplane patent pool during World War I, it was almost impossible to create an airplane with all these different, the technologies were different companies. Radios, the U.S. government needed radio technology during World War I, exempted defense companies from infringing on patents so they could make this technology. But then what ended up happening in one of the patent pools is Radio Corporation of America, RCA, was created. And then all the big players have a patent pool and can license to each other. But what if you're an upstart or a new company that comes along that has a new technology and can't get those licenses? And so to the extent that maybe Apple, Samsung, HTC, Google cross-license to each other, that still isn't the best outcome for startups or new companies that aren't part of that club. And we might see an analogy in the acquisition of the Nortel patents, which included Microsoft, Apple, all coalition, but it excluded some other companies. And so I still tend to think the solution would be getting rid of these patents in general. But I think that we're going to see a lot more defensive patenting, a lot more litigation, maybe some pooling at some point if the courts don't figure it out and don't come up with the solutions that, say, Dick Posner and others have proposed. But if we end up with a pool, I do think that's not the best for startups.
Mr. McFerris, you have a...
Sure, thanks. So, as Professor Mossoff points out very rightly, there's been patent litigation for, centuries. And and in new technologies that happens, there will be competitors who want to fight over their rights, and that's happening today, which is why, in the context of Apple, Samsung, the large product manufacturers, I think that kind of litigation will continue. And I would, be willing to be persuaded that that is just a natural offshoot of the competitive marketplace. That's the kind of litigation we've seen all along. I mean, we could reduce it. I do think it's inefficient in some ways. I do think some of the patents are too broad, and we could cut down on it. It's really the NPE, the troll type litigation, that I think is new, at least as far as modern times, and is the more damaging and something that I think we could profitably get rid of if we could. I don't think that certainty of rights, this is in response to Professor Mossoff, I don't think that certainty of rights is necessarily the be-all and end-all of the system. This is not, I think, like the housing market. I mean, I guess I would actually push back on the assertion that the housing crash was caused by uncertainty over rights, and I do think the ownership of those houses and even of the CDOs in question were pretty well known. There's speculation ran up the prices, but I don't know that it was an ownership issue. But that aside, I think that with buying a house, your whole point in buying the house is to own that property. And so, yes, certainty of the property right is very important. With innovation and invention, I think that the point of innovation is not just to get patents. The point of innovation should be to make more products, to sell more products, to get market share, all of these great things that companies do. Getting patents is an incentive, it's a byproduct, but to say that we should structure these industries to make patenting more certain, it seems like the tail wagging the dog to some degree. And I think the system can tolerate some level of uncertainty as the courts decide and refine these rights. I don't think we need to freeze or enshrine the rights in such a way simply so that they're more certain. As far as patent pools are great. Where patent pools have made sense, companies have gotten together in advance and put them together. And the trick with patent pools is that it costs millions of dollars to put a patent pool together up front. For all sorts of reasons, there are antitrust considerations, and the regulators have told us that to have a pool, you have to be very careful about what goes in it because you've got competitors getting together. And so it's not easy, and in DVD technology, CD, MPEG, which are the famous pools, and some of the telecom 3GPP technology, where you have pools where you have letters from the Department of Justice sanctioning these and saying they're okay, they're structured very carefully. In other spaces where companies want to get to market quicker, just make products, it's much more difficult and time-consuming to put a pool together. Yes, in the Aircraft Manufacturers Association and so forth, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the Secretary of the Navy, twisted the arm of the Wright Company, to throw all the patents into a pool. Otherwise, we would have lost World War I. That's a very important national consideration. I'm not sure that that's going to happen here. I don't know if it's appropriate for the government to do that kind of arm twisting in a purely commercial market where you don't have a very significant national security interest. I've written other industries where we do have a national interest, like the electrical grid. I would encourage the government to take a more active role if it's protecting energy security. But in mobile telephony, I'm not sure I would go that far. But if people can come up with a pooling solution, I think that's great. More power to them.
Professor Mossoff.
Okay, just real quickly. I think it's clear that, yes, I think that the litigation today is a natural product. It's, calling it inefficient doesn't make it inefficient. And if someone could show me a study that says that shows you that it's inefficient and this is causing losses in the overall systemic innovation that we have in our society, then I would certainly be up here advocating that we need to change the patent system in some way, shape, or form. But the problem is that the one thing that we never have is any definitive studies at the systemic level of patent system. For every study that I can show you that the patent system is inefficient or your patent should be thrown out, I can show you a counter study that says the exact opposite or shows that the problems of the regression analysis in that study. I think Joshua Wright, my colleague at George Mason, who is just nominated to become an FTC commissioner, I think rightly observed that our skills and economics and our capacity to measure innovation has not yet reached the level where we can come up with any definitive studies on this point. And it's also interesting, you know, that Mark mentions the engineers being opposed to IP. The engineers have always been opposed to IP, and it's not just patents. They were opposed to copyright protection in software. And back in the 60s and 70s, you know, we now assume, they should get protection in copyright. And we've forgotten this huge historical battle that occurred in the 1960s and 70s with the Copyright Office as to whether software should be copyrighted or not, because there were people who were opposed to that. And some of the people who were opposed to it were not just firms, were also most software programmers at that time were opposed to it because they saw this as restricting their ability to engage in innovative tinkering with the software that they were developing. Recall at that time, too, we did not have this is the PC revolution, the software revolution. So you couldn't produce necessarily the same experience on the screen with different software. The software was intimately linked to the experience that you had, which explains the shift to patent protection in the late 80s and early 90s when copyright no longer provided adequate protection for the software product as a product experienced by the end user because that could be replicated with different software code. That's the Borland decision involving the pull-down menus was it Excel database?
Or? Lotus.
Lotus 1-2-3 database. I'll just say, you know, with respect to licensing activities and so-called trolls, I would just be very careful about use of that phrase because you end up including a lot of people that you don't necessarily want to include in that term. Universities don't manufacture. They just license. Universities are not were not the inventors. The professors were. The professors then sold their patents, conveyed them, the term is assigned them, to the university. So do we want to start calling universities trolls? Elias Howe, the inventor of the lock stitch, was destitute. And when he wanted to start suing the sewing manufacturers who were violating his patents, he had no money. So he sold a security interest in his patent in order to obtain funding. And then when he went to Isaac Singer and said, "You're infringing my patent on my lock stitch," Isaac Singer threatened to kill him by throwing him down the stairs. Right? Remember, this is 1851. You couldn't send him an email. You know, today Isaac Singer would send him a flame email back saying, "How dare you talk to me? You know, don't go blah blah blah." Right?
Send a telegram.
Howe had to go and visit Singer twice to ask for. To enter into a licensing agreement, Singer's business partner at the time noted in a later lawsuit, he said, Howe was lucky to have left with his arms intact. Charles Goodyear, who has nothing to do with the Goodyear tire company that was formed 50 years after he died, Goodyear never manufactured a single rubber product. He made all of his money by licensing his patent. All of it. Because he didn't want to be a manufacturer. He wanted to license his patent. And moreover, Thomas Edison. Thomas Edison ran the very first research intensive firm in this country, right? Menlo Park in New Jersey. He put his name on every company that they licensed their patents to, but he wasn't running those companies. He was having his patents from his research company licensed to those companies, and then he was using the money he was getting from them not to run Edison Power, but to run Menlo Park. He was interested in coming up with more inventions, and as a result, patented 1,100 inventions. I mean, these are people who made their money solely through licensing of their patents, because that's what the patent system is about. I agree, it's entirely about incentivizing inventions, too, but it's not entirely about that. I suppose I shouldn't say entirely. There's two functions to the patent system. It incentivizes new innovation, or incentivizes new inventions, but inventions are not innovation. Inventions are not the products you get in your hand. It's a huge process, commercial, capitalistic process, to go from the engineer or the inventor who conceives of this in the lab to the final product in your hand. And that product involves lots of companies setting up supply chains, setting up distribution facilities, setting up entering into contracts with wholesalers, setting up manufacturers. Apple, you know, the reason why domestic companies are going to the ITC is because Apple is not a manufacturer. There, as you as everyone knows now from the New York newspaper reports, iPhones are being manufactured not by Apple but by Chinese firms in mainland China and are being shipped into the United States. So you need property rights in order to do that, and people will not enter into contracts, will not enter into commercial exchanges without first having properties. They can't. Again, you can't have commerce without first having the exclusive right to determine how to control something before that you go out into the market in exchange with that. Those are my final remarks.
Robbie, something brief to add, and then we'll get right into questions.
Yeah. As far as studies showing numbers, there was actually a pretty good one came out from, I think, I'm not a statistician, mind you, two professors at Boston University School of Law in June. If you Google direct costs from NPE disputes, they calculated NPE patent assertions grew to $29 billion of direct costs in 2011. Most of the defendants were small and medium-sized firms. So there is a cost. People have at least tried to calculate it. As far as what happens next, I think it's hard to tell depending on what Apple wants to do. And, of course, Apple never says quite what Apple wants to do. If they decide that this is a financial problem to solve and not we must destroy Android, shouldn't be that hard to craft some kind of patent pool solution. But the issue here isn't whether will Apple be all right. Apple will be fine. Samsung will be fine. Microsoft and Google, they're not going to be hurt too badly. It's all the smaller companies we haven't heard about that are in little garages and somewhere in Silicon Valley or, you know, some boring office park in the Dulles Toll Road. How are they going to do? They don't have the money for us to have attorneys on retainer. And if the system doesn't work for them, then I would say it's not working. The last thing, the thing that kind of sticks in my craw, just as an observer of this and as somebody who wants to see innovative companies succeed, is when these small startups get hit by a company that is clearly abusive, that's claiming an invention that they didn't actually invent, the patent should have been granted, and there seems no penalty for abusing the law like that. Now, what you do have in some states is what's called an anti-slap law. It says if you file a lawsuit against a critic of yours, a strategic lawsuit against public participation, that person can countersue, and it's not that hard to stop that whole process. There's nothing like that in the patent system. Like they did a post for the Consumer Electronics Association around the time a bill called the Shield Act was introduced, which would basically say, which judges can already do, if somebody files a patent suit that they had no reasonable expectation of winning, the judge can stick the loser with the winner's legal fees, which the judge can already do but never does. I talked to some people, said, what else would you like to see? And one of the more interesting ideas I heard was, why not penalize people who make patent trolling their business model? Put some accountability in the system so that if all you do is inventory patents, hundreds of shell companies, not them talking about any particular Paul Allen firm or anything, there's going to be some legal costs besides what you pay your attorneys and the time you spend in court. But that would require Congress to do something, so we'll see.
Okay, I'd like to open up for questions. If you'll please say your name and affiliation. Are you in the front?
I'm Frank Bruno with Oracle. I have a couple of questions around standard retention patents. The way I see this, two policy issues, one upstream and one downstream, that I'd like your thoughts on. Upstream, you should early disclosure within the standard development process. The company makes a contribution to development of patents. What the effect of early disclosure that contribution, by the way, is patent protected, and what licensing terms, that the effect of that early disclosure on innovation. So that's upstream. Downstream, the issue of injunction when a standard essential patent is a subject of a RAND commitment, whether injunctive relief should be available to the patent holder, DOJ in a speech recently in Geneva took position essentially against that.
You've written on this.
So those are good questions. Obviously, very hot topics right now. So on the disclosure point, right? Disclosure is always good. I think there are two types of disclosure in the standards context. There's disclosure of your patents, and almost, well, many standards organizations require that you disclose patents if they're going to be essential to the standard. Disclose them early in the process. Why? For a number of reasons, right? So that you know who has the patents, and if you want to implement that standard, you can go and negotiate a license with them up front. Also, if you disclose the patent, then the engineers developing the standard can design around the patent if they feel they want to. If they feel the royalty rate is going to be too high or difficult, or they just don't like the company that disclosed the patent. So early disclosure is good, and I think not many people disagree that disclosure of patents is very beneficial. Now, the controversial disclosure point is whether standards groups should require early disclosure of licensing terms, royalty rates, right? That's the big question. And I personally believe that that would be a good idea. You have to be careful from an antitrust standpoint that that doesn't essentially allow people to fix prices around patent licenses. But I think in an open manner, if you had a procedure to require disclosure of maximum royalty rates, this has been done. It was done at a group called VITA, and the Department of Justice approved the structure that they put in place. You know, then I think giving that extra information to potential implementers of the patent is a good thing. But I think it's not enough. Merely disclosing royalty rates is not enough because what you disclose could be too high, right? Or there are 20 patent holders. They each disclose a rate that on its own could be reasonable. You know, it still, at the end of the day, when you get them all together, could be 20 times higher than what a reasonable market could bear on a particular product. So I think there's also more work that needs to be done. And I, you know, submitted comments to that same panel in Geneva at the ITU about potentially having some sort of combined approach to looking at the totality of the patent holders and the royalty demands that they would make for a particular standard, and trying to contain the aggregate level, because I think only, and this is a personal view, probably minority view, only by looking at the aggregate royalty burden on a particular standard are you going to be able to have a reasonable burden once the standard is created, once it's approved and out there. As far as injunctions, you know, the standards for injunctions are different in courts around the world. I think somebody mentioned the Mannheim Court in Germany.
Especially Mannheim is
you know, quite liberal with injunctions. I don't know what the standard for injunctions is in Germany, but it's quite low.
Bring a note from your mother, I think. Is
You know, federal district court in the U.S., we have this test the Supreme Court handed down about 6 years ago in the eBay case, which has four parts, and there are reasons. And in federal district court, if you have agreed that money damages will be sufficient for your injury, then you can't get an injunction. You're entitled. You can go seek your monetary damages, right? And you know, many people think that that means that if you've agreed to license your patent on fair, reasonable, non-discriminatory terms, you've agreed to accept a monetary royalty for it, then you shouldn't be able to get an injunction. Now, that standard does not apply in the ITC. This is another reason that I have this problem with these parallel suits, whether they're 70 or 50. It's the 70 or 50 biggest lawsuits that are, you know, going to the ITC.
They have a public interest prong in there.
That's the only prong.
Well, and they're starting to employ it.
Well, they're getting urged by the FTC and a large segments of the industry to apply that one prong that they have and try to import that eBay style analysis into their consideration. We don't know what's going to happen yet. They've kind of held off to a large degree on deciding that question, but it'll be interesting to see.
Another question from the audience?
Can I just make one point? I mean, there is a counter argument on the injunction that you can make or I could make, which is essentially that if the person who contributes a standard essential patent doesn't have the ability to seek injunction later, there's less incentive to be part of a standard. There's incentive to encourage standards. And then also, if they don't have the ability to have an injunction, then that gives them less leverage in negotiating for a reasonable rate. So that's sort of the counter argument.
And it can be part of the standard-setting organization's agreement that they can preclude also, they can reach a private agreement that the patents may not be enforced through injunctions. I mean, so they can restrict themselves if they wish to. So if this is actually in all of the patent owner's interest in entering into the SSO, they can agree to that. And for the same reasons that they now agree to disclosure of patents given prior past situations where patents weren't disclosed in the entering into SSOs, and now they've all got clauses that say everyone promises to disclose every relevant patent that the SSO is going to be adopted.
Rambus, right?
Well, yes. but that was resolved by after that.
After
so that
many,
was a one-off.
Many years of
yes.
litigation.
Well, but it's a one-off, and they've solved it.
In the back, I believe there's a question.
Tyler Thompson, Senator Moran's office. As a software engineer by trade, it seems to me like these companies are patenting the utility of spell check, per se. And in doing so, they're stifling my ability to go in and make it more efficient, improve on the standards, and innovate on top of that without litigation and licensing. How do we prevent or how do we resolve this
Well, that, I think that you hit on the exact point that I mentioned, which is that the commercial value is in the product as it's sold and experienced by the end user. The end user doesn't care what the object code is. The end user cares, do I have pull-down menus? And so copyright does not secure that value as a business product if you can do different pull-down menus with different code. And I think that's why it was a natural development in the late 1980s and early 1990s when firms started pushing for more strict pure software protection, because software was becoming a product as a result of the PC revolution in the early 1980s. That was, you know, there used to be egghead stores. You'd go and buy a box, and it was a software box, and you weren't buying the code. You didn't care what the code was. You cared what the program could do for you. You the spell check, the menus, the WYSIWYG, the print on command. Things of that sort. And so, for those of you who don't, oh, I'm sorry, acronym. Well, what you see is what you get. Sorry about that. I violated Eric's rule. The problem is, this was the problem of pharma patents when pharmaceutical molecules were being developed in the early 20th century. When the patent system is extended to new types of innovation, it doesn't know a priori, how it works out, because all of the standards in the patent system are defined by the nature of the person having skill in the art. And so there has to be time for you to develop that skill in the art, to figure out, well, what is non-obvious in this field? What is purely novel? What is useful? And that takes some time. And it's very important to recognize that something, a restriction or a cost is not the same thing as inefficiency. If that was true, our entire lives upside down, backwards forward would be inefficient. It would be inefficient to you to go grocery shopping because you have to pay for gas. Transaction costs are a fact of life. That you can't escape them. And there's no economist who's right in the mind who thinks that the standard of basis for evaluating the efficiency of our legal system is zero transaction costs. Because if that was our standard, we could never escape inefficiency. So
can I try a shot? So I think you said, how do we solve a problem? And he tried to convince you it wasn't a problem. So the way to solve the problem, and Senator Moran is very, very pro-startup. I'm a big fan of a lot of your boss's work. One way to solve it would be, this professor named Mark Lemley has a paper on functional claiming, to something that we were sort of discussing, the idea of claims around functions versus claims around the actual technology. So if there's a way to sort of get at that problem, so that's one way to try to solve it, sort of eliminating or moving away from functional claiming. Also, sort of raising the standard on what's non-obviousness. What would be non-obvious, right? Like, you get a patent for something, and to most people who are skilled in the art like you, it would seem like an obvious idea, right? So that might be another way. But functional claiming really gets at the core. And in terms of efficiency, I mean, certainly everyone knows high transaction costs can lead to inefficient outcomes. Right? So we try to avoid that. I think the patent system imposes more transaction costs than it should for efficient outcomes. And one, and we've been talking about, you know, sort of studies and studies that people should look at. There's actually a great new study out by a woman named Colleen Chen, C-H-I-E-N, on startups and patents. And it's both a quantitative study but also qualitative. She interviews a lot of startup founders. And, you know, her conclusions tend to be that a lot of these, you know, non-practicing entities that just, you know, hoard lots of patents, what they end up doing is that if a startup goes bust, they might buy up a whole bunch of their patents and just stockpile them. And if you have 1,000 patents, then you can go threaten some small company that doesn't have a lawyer yet and say, we have 5 patents to assert against you, and if you don't settle, we'll assert these other 5 and these other 5, and it will never end. And so what we see in that study is that a lot of startups bear the brunt of the litigation that we see. It's not just the largest companies. And so, and then one other point that hasn't been raised, if I can raise it, in addition to the burden on startups, consumers, hobbyists, when you were talking about going into a program and sort of improving it, it reminded me of open source technology. And so open source technology is subject to a lot, to various, you know, contracts, et cetera, that let people improve on the technology. Linux, the famous example, and there's other open source technology, Mozilla. And I have an office at the New America Foundation where I'm a fellow, and there's an open technology institute there that gets funding from the state, from State Departments, Radio Free Asia, et cetera, creating open source security technologies for dissidents in Iran or China, et cetera, to use, things that make people more secure in repressive regimes. And those are all open source. And to the extent that we're, you know, we as a U.S. government are funding open source technologies because of their security, we also have the problem of having to clear patents, having to deal with this patent thicket out there of all these functional ideas simply to, you know, improve the world pro-democratic ways through this program. And so that's just one example I know fairly well, but the problem of the effect on open source and on government technologies is also another one to think about.
I'm so glad you mentioned open source. You know, people sort of forget we've been having this discussion as if strong intellectual property protection is a requirement for progress. But for the past 30 or so years, we've been running this experiment. Well, what if you develop software and you publish your source code, let anyone else take it, improve it? The most popular open source code license, I don't know if it's most popular, one of the more popular ones, the GPL says it's viral. So if you take someone's open source code, you can't make it your own. You have to share your changes with everyone else as well. And you know, it works. If you use an iPhone, you're benefiting from open source in the form of the WebKit foundation of the browser. If you use an Android phone, you're also benefiting from that same open source foundation. Safari, Firefox, Chrome, they're all built on open source technology. And if you talk to a lot of the sort of intellectual property maximalists, those products, those programs shouldn't exist. And the evidence would suggest
that. They're the evidence of what you have when you have a default system where people can choose to exercise their property rights. Property rights are rooted in what people create. And if you create something, then the law secures in you the right to choose how to dispose of that. And if you choose to dispose of it by giving it away for free or going through requiring attribution like in the Creative Commons license, and therefore pursue contractual type relationships with your right to your property, then that is actually exactly what our system is intended to promote. And in fact, it's the diversity of, it's allowing for property rights that allows for diversity of business models like that, right? The diversity of business, when you secure individual property rights in what people create, you get diversity of business models, and that's exactly what you want, and that's exactly what we have, and that's what you can choose. And you can choose to get a patent, you can choose your trade secrecy protection, you can choose to try to get copyright if it's appropriate, or you can pursue a type of Creative Commons or open source type site protection system.
Can I agree with Adam quickly just to say that? Well, sure, Adam, I don't want to put words in your mouth, wouldn't agree that you should have property protection for every idea out there. So we have to draw a line somewhere. Property isn't always good. And we have to simply determine at what point should we grant ideas property protection.
Yeah, it's the same issues in real property. We don't grant property rights to people every time they take one step on a piece of land. There's a whole set of requirements for what people have to do.
And it's both in
patent law, copyright, and real property. And in fact, I spend my entire semester teaching my students all of the complex ways that the law imposes minimum requirements on people in order to claim property rights in land.
But isn't Rob's point about open source, not to put words in your mouth, but that you don't have to have strong property protection to incentivize creation, right? It's a story about incentives. And I think what we hear a lot is that you must have strong rights to incentivize creation. But I think that's the that's the counterexample. I think it's a valid counterexample.
I want to be sure we get any additional questions here. Is there any folks? Anyone else? Okay, right here in front.
They come up with hands.
From BSA Software Alliance, and I was just curious. I'm not going to ask a necessarily software question, but are you guys aware of any innovation that's been taken off the market?
I can name one. I'll show my age. I'm like, gray hair is not doing it already. I had a Palm handheld back in the 90s, and I'd gotten a little too good at the graffiti handwriting recognition alphabet of it. I started actually doing my own writing in graffiti. And then I had to relearn it because Xerox filed a suit, said, hey, we invented this. There were some disputes. I don't even remember how it finally worked out. Basically, Palm said, it's easier for us to introduce Graffiti 2, which was less efficient, kind of a pain, and I had to relearn everything. So there was an innovation that vanished from the market because Xerox never did anything with it.
But wouldn't the argument be that Palm 2 was a better, Graffiti 2 was a better product?
No, it wasn't. I used both.
Well, yes.
I mean, there was a recent example in a New York Times article about a voice recognition technology.
Well, that was
that,
more
that,
a
that became Siri.
Grotesque malfeasance by Goldman Sachs.
Siri was asserting that.
Yeah.
And that was the point, is like Siri was able to use the patent to then promote itself to be sold to Apple.
You asked the specific question of one technology that's been off the market. That's one that was given in the New York Times. I mean, I haven't talked to enough people who've told me that they have. I don't know.
I'm going to move on right here in front.
I just want to respond. I represent a company that is literally a startup in the dorm room at a college. And they decided not to go forward with their plan because they couldn't get the funding to get a patent. And they couldn't get funding for their idea without a patent because they couldn't go to the people who would have to fund them who would take their idea.
So I guess that was true. My point was more like because of the patent.
Yeah.
That was because they weren't able to get the funding for it.
Yeah.
Well, we haven't talked much about it, but in biotech and biomedicine, there are tons of those examples, right? I mean, this is what the fight is about with Myriad Genetics.
Right.
Locked up the diagnostic test market for BRCA1 and 2. It's old technology. It could be much improved, but, you know, they sent demand letters to universities who are running the tests. It's a very long story, but I think outside of, I mean, you know, in there are those examples that exist.
That was a pharmaceutical, which we all sort of agreed on the panel, that system is working relatively.
Not that it doesn't have its own, yeah, it was wrong panel, but there are definitely some issues in the pharma world, too.
And we have time for one more question right here on the left in the dark suit.
Have you identified yourself? Sorry, I'm Patrick Wilson with the Semiconductor Industry Association. And my question is really more to ask the panelists about pity the poor staffer here, right? We've seen this debate for a couple years now. And I often wonder that at the same time while we complain that the Innovation Act didn't do enough and not enough actions happened, all the experts in patent law can't agree on what the right course of action is. So what to do about this? Should we find the common ground? I mean, there's a Venn diagram up there of the stuff we all agree sucks and we focus more on that.
Can I just make a point?
I'm confused about what you would encourage them to do.
So when we were trying to find someone who could defend the AIA, I emailed a friend of mine who I thought could maybe defend it. And she said, you're not going to find anyone to defend it. That's like defending Hitler in the past. I thought that was really funny. So, I mean, there's pretty...
It's not that bad.
She just felt like it's not going to happen to any defenders. But it was something like that. Like, no one's going to defend it.
Yeah, so Godwin's law was just violated.
It was in an email. So the point is, like, not that many people defend that exact law. And so I think that there are lots of different fixes, right? The long list of fixes that he was talking about. I don't have that much faith in complex government interventions or in complex statutes. Right? I think the simpler the fix, the better, which is one of the reasons why I tend to opt towards simply eliminating business method and software patents. But a lot of the non-obviousness proposals and the same essential patents proposals, they strike me as fairly complicated. Fee shifting and slap suits, they might be helpful. But in terms of just, you know, how do we have like a one-line statute or a three-line statute that goes a long way on this issue. I think that would go a long way.
I want to thank each of our panelists for a great discussion today. Thank you all for coming, and we look forward to seeing you at future events. Thank you very much.
I don't think you're a copyright actually.